So. We're going to call this algorithm Tux algorithm. It's sometimes called this. It's not always called this because this guy Tut. Familiar with Tut? Who's heard of this guy before? W-E-T, Tut. He's a brilliant, brilliant graph theorist. Came up with all kinds of algorithms, so it's almost messed up to call a particular algorithm Tut's algorithm because he did all these other things as well, but I take the initiative to do this because I like this so much. He's also, you may know, like Tut's theorem, something about bipartite graphs. A lot of things on graph theory go back to this guy. So 1963, wrote this paper, How to Draw a Graph. Didn't completely settle the question of how to do it, but gave a very nice algorithm. So, in fact, he was trying to do something even better than just how to draw a graph. He wanted to get, not just to get a straight line drawing with no edges crossed. He wanted something even better. So here was the situation he wanted. Given a simple planar, reconnected graph. Find a straight line drawing, also called a PSLG, such that every face is a convex polygon. This is what's called a convex representation of the graph. Now, with regards to theorems about the existence of certain kinds of drawings of graphs, thus far I had to simply assert their existence. We didn't prove Fari's theorem. It's not so hard to do. Fari's theorem is the one that says that every planar graph can be drawn with straight lines. Well, this one, here's another one where you say, hey, does this even exist? Even if we buy Fari's theorem, we don't necessarily know that we can draw it so the faces are convex. Well, the key in this is this triple of qualifiers. Simple, planar, three connected. Simple graph means what? No double edges and no self-loops. Planar means there exists at least a planar embedding. And three connected, remember when we talked about PSLGs, the connectivity did tell us a lot about faces, and in particular, pre-connected meant Whitney's theorem applied, so the faces were at least unique, so that no matter how you draw a simple planar pre-connected graph, the edges of the vertices along any face are going to be the same sets. You're going to get the same sets of faces. Well, it's in fact related to an even older and maybe perhaps more famous in some ways theorem, which is called Steinitz's theorem. And again, Steinitz was a great mathematician, so there's something else called Steinitz's theorem as well. But we'll at least, for now, for the sake of this class, Steinitz's theorem is as follows. Every simple planar pre-connected graph is the I'm going to write it like this. I can call it the one skeleton of a convex polyhedron. Okay, so the one skeleton is just the edges and vertices. Here's a convex polytope in R3. It's a cube. If I look at the cube, if the one skeleton of the cube is 8 vertices and 12 edges. It's a graph. So that's a graph. It turns out it's simple, it's planar, and it's 3 connected. So this graph can be drawn in the plane as well via a kind of stereographic projection. Remember, stereographic projection is where you just put a point up here and you put the plane down here. And you look from this point through each vertex and you just project each vertex down into the plane from this point. And that will project this cube onto the plane in a way that looks something like this. So this gives you a drawing, in fact, a convex representation of that polytope. You have to be careful about how you do stereographic projection so that it actually works. For now, let's just say as long as you project from a point that's very close to the top face, you arrange your polytope in R3 so one face is flat and on top, and you project from a point that's just above it, you'll get a nice projection. And that, in general, is called a Schlegel diagram, but we won't be dealing with that right now. So it looks like, at first, this conceptually gives you a way to have such a drawing, and this theorem really does go back a ways. I think it was 1920s, although there are modern proofs which are much cooler. In fact, one of my absolute favorite proofs of Stein's theorem uses Tata's algorithm. So at some point we'll prove Stein's theorem, but we'll do it via Tata's algorithm. Okay, and we won't use Stein's theorem to guarantee this existence, the existence of such a convex representation. We'll just run the algorithm and check that it's correct. We'll just prove that if you run Tata's algorithm, which I haven't told you what it is yet, but if you run it, you can just check that every face is convex. Okay? So that's the game plan. Here's the idea. The idea is to apply a physical intuition. So you imagine that the edges are springs. You view the edges as springs. And you just let them pull on the vertices and pull the vertices around. And the hope is that they'll just pull the vertices into the right positions so they won't get crossed up or locked up. That alone is not quite enough. But let's talk about springs, first of all. Remember the physics of a spring? Who can tell me Hooke's law for springs? Is that any of you, Hooke? I think maybe. Okay. So Hooke's law tells you what the force of a spring is. What's Hooke's law?
F equals K.
Yes. The force is equal to something constant, right? Which is the spring constant, I'll call it spring constant, times the displacement, often just x, right? How much did you stretch the spring? If you stretch it more, the force is more. And so if you have, for instance, a spring attached to the ceiling, you hang a weight from it, the weight is going to exert the force of gravity on the weight is going to come down. How much is it going to pull it down? Well, it's going to pull it down until the force, or that is to say the spring constant times the amount that got stretched, is exactly equal to the force of gravity. So it pulls up with the exact same force as it pulls down, and then it's in what we call equilibrium. Okay, so that's Hooke's law. So it tells us how to think about or how to compute force from displacement. There's one thing to remember in Hooke's law is usually there's a resting length of a spring. And so there's some, it has some fixed length, and depending on how much you stretch it from that fixed length. Well, we're going to imagine a certain kind of idealized spring where the resting length is just zero. And so what that looks like is I have, let's write it like this, two points, A and B. And so if I have a spring between them, the force exerted by the spring is a vector, and let's ask, what is the force exerted on A? It's a vector which is k times the vector b minus a. Okay, assuming it's b minus a is the vector that goes from here to here, and k is the spring constant. Now notice, if I make k to be negative, which is totally okay, it would be it would actually be pushing it away instead of pulling it closer. So that's not so bad. And this satisfies all our usual rules with points and vectors. So here I just drew these as two points in the plane. Their difference is a vector. Force is a vector. And you know, forces are additive. That's why vectors so naturally arise in both your elementary physics and then in linear algebra. If we have many such springs attached to a particular point, so let's take some point Q here, and let's say it has a bunch of neighbors. Let's call them P1, P2, up all the way to PH. Then I can compute the force exerted on Q from all of these springs just by adding them up. Each one of them is going to give me a vector, I just add up the vectors. And we're going to do something even simpler, is that we're going to assume from now on that this k is always equal to 1. We're going to build this system of springs, and all those springs are going to be spring constant 1. And so what do we get for the force on q? Let's call it F sub q. It's just the sum from I equals 1 to h of pi minus q. And if you were to factor this, or to separate this into two sums, what you would immediately see is that this is the sum from I equals 1 to h of pi minus h cubed. And if we were to ask for, if we were to look for the situation, the configurations which are in equilibrium, then at least equilibrium at Q, then we would expect this net force to be zero. So when is this equal to zero? If this is zero, and it's equal to this, that implies that HQ is equal to the sum of the PIs. Well, let's divide everything by H, and that's the same as saying 1 over H times the sum of the PIs is equal to Q. And now this is the heart of that algorithm I was describing, in fact, sort of implementing. You see, the sum of the PIs divided by their number, that's the centroid. It's just the average of all their coordinates. This is a convex combination, so I haven't broken any of our point vector rules here. And it's just saying that Q is equal to the centroid of all of its neighbors. Any questions? Easy, right? All right. So just from starting to view this as springs, once we have the edges and we have some coordinates for the points, we could compute the force at each point. And we could hope that the forces come out to zero, but you could, if I just put them down arbitrarily, there might be that the net force is some vector here at Q. So the first thing you might try, it's not such a bad thing to do, is to just start moving this point in this direction. Say, well, let's start pushing everybody in the direction of the force. This is a little bit like simulating this system of springs. Turns out you don't have to do that. In fact, we'll show that you can find how to place every point so that it's at the center of its neighbors simultaneously, except for one thing, which is that if I really wanted every point to be at the center of its neighbors, there's only one solution, and it's boring. The only way to get every point to be at the center of its neighbors is to put every point on top of the other, so they're all just the same point. It's the only way to do it. Let's just check. Suppose I give you some other solution. I say, here's where you put the points. And now when you draw the graph on this simple plane and pre-connected graph, that every point is at the centroid of its neighbors. Well, we know there's a convex hull here. Let's take any point on the convex hull, and you have a supporting line here. All of the neighbors of this point are on this side of the line. And so its centroid is also strictly on that side of the line, so it's not at its centroid. So there's something on the boundary, we know everything would get pulled in. And if you play the planarity game this way, if you say, I'm just going to keep taking the points and moving them towards the centroid, well, it starts to collapse. And the physical intuition should kick in as well. If these are all springs, and they're all just everybody's pulling on everyone, there's no reason why it won't just keep collapsing to a point. So this idea, we need another idea, and this picture actually gives us a hint of what that idea is. That is, we're going to find one face on the outside, and we're going to lock it down. So if you remember from the convex hull, we took this intuition that if the points are nails in a piece of wood, and you wrap a string around them, around all the nails, the convex hull is exactly the polygon you get from the string on the outside. Again, we're going to take that some outer face, we're going to nail it down. And now the other points, rather than being nails, are going to be just connected by springs, and now they can't all collapse to a point because there's at least this one outer face that's pulling it back out, that's holding it together, and in the end, this will be enough. So that's the high-level view of this algorithm. So what are we actually going to do here? That's how algorithm looks like this. It might even be better to call it Tuts embedding because the internal part of the algorithm will be linear algebra, in which case we're going to outsource to even different algorithms. But Tuts embedding is the following. Fix one face on I think usually he puts it on a circle. So if you have one face, you can take a circle and you can make it a nice convex polygon with the vertices on the circle. Place every, I'm going to say the other vertices as the ones that are not on this outer face, this is our outer face, at the centroid of its neighbors. So again, this is something we have to prove that you can even do this. Like at first, it should not be obvious to you that there is a way to put everyone at the center of his neighbors. Think about it. If you have a point that's not at the center of his neighbors, and you move it to be at the center of his neighbors, if every one of his neighbors now would also have to move again to be at the center right of their neighbors. But then that means I have to move this other point again. And it seems to go on forever, and you wonder, like, is there any equilibrium? Does this thing ever stop? What do you think? Does anyone have a reason why maybe it should stop? Well, think about the physical intuition. This is real springs. You wouldn't expect this to just, the forces to be constantly in some perpetual motion.
There has to be one man that is going to come to an equilibrium. So it should converge at some point.
You'd think so. Yeah, and it's true. And so let's see why it's true. Turns out to be, you can see the truth of this statement just from the algebra. So that's what we'll get to. All right. So, remember, the forces are all linear operations, right? But the forces are vectors, and computing the forces is just adding up the vectors. And the vectors themselves are just differences of coordinates on the points. So there's going to be a matrix involved here. So I have L, which is going to be n by n. And the diagonal entries of L are the degree of the vertex pi. Okay, I'm overloading, technically this is okay. I'm using pi to be the point, but it's also the vertex in the graph. So remember that the vertex set of this graph is a set of points in the plane. We don't yet know what the points are going to be. We're going to find their embedding, but we know at least what the degree is, because we have the graph. Input was the graph. So we can talk about the degree in the graph, and we're going to make this matrix have diagonal entries equal to the degree, and the off-diagonal entries, so for all j not equal to I, L I j is equal to, it's going to be negative 1 if pj is incident to pi, and 0 otherwise. Yeah, question.
In the previous idea, you said that we fix an outer face on a circle. But what's the input of the algorithm? I think we have just some function of the relation between
the graphs.
Yeah. We don't have any embeddings. And how can we find a face?
How do you find a face? Yes. Okay, so this is an important part where we'll get to it, but maybe I'll give you the preview. From Whitney's theorem, we know that there are faces, but it's true. How do you get to the face until you've drawn it? Turns out, the following is true of that. If you have a cycle, and if you remove that cycle, and the graph is still connected, and it's a face. So there's a purely combinatorial definition of the faces. So you can look for cycles such that when you remove that cycle, the graph is still connected. And if in fact it disconnects the graph, then you can find a smaller cycle that cuts through that one, and you search for the smaller and smallest cycle until you get to one. Right. When you remove that, all the vertices in that cycle, the graph is still connected. Yeah.
Do we care what face means there? Do some faces make for better drawings?
It may be true that some faces make for better drawings. It's almost definitely true for certain kinds of graphs. But any face you pick is going to work. And we'll see that. A nice example is, you imagine that you have a grid, a really big grid. The best way to draw a really big grid is to draw it as a really big grid. And now it has a lot of edges on the outer face. All the other faces just have four edges. If you try to draw it with one of those squares as the outer face, then somewhere in there you're going to have a huge square root of n, four times the square root of n size cycle. And it won't be such a nice drawing. But that's its own problem. So,
Can we find this type of face with local searches?
Yes. Okay. It's certainly easiest in graphs like triangulations, where you're just looking for a triangle locally. But even triangulations, there can be triangles which are not faces. So with that, I guess we probably won't get to that part of the algorithm today. But it's true. Take my word for it. You can find a face to bootstrap this process. In fact, a big part of what Seth did in this paper was to develop a theory guarantee that you can do that. For now, let's look at this matrix L. Is this clear? Has anyone seen this matrix before? T-Rex fans? No? It's a very famous matrix. It's the most important matrix. I'm going to say this. It's the most important matrix associated with a graph.
Identity. There's a negative in there, so that's confusing.
Yeah, what is that? It's more important than the adjacency matrix. I'm just going to go ahead and say that. You've probably seen the adjacency matrix. Have a graph,
yeah.
Adjacency matrix. This is way more important than the adjacency matrix. This. Was it?
Laplacian.
It's the Laplacian. This is the Laplacian. So let's say that D is the degree matrix. It's a diagonal degree matrix. And A is the adjacency matrix. L here is equal to D minus A. Laplacian shows up everywhere. It's related to physical forces, electrodynamics,
what's so important
heat flow. What?
What's so important about it?
Well, it describes all kinds of physical phenomena. So we're going to see that it shows up here to describe forces in equilibrium. So it also shows up in electrical systems. This is how you compute the effect of resistance between two nodes in an electrical network, the graph, by solving linear systems based on the graph Laplacian. It's how you look at how heat flows on anything. Okay. This is it. In fact, solving the linear systems that come out of Laplacian is the state of the art for doing such mundane problems like max flow. It's used in image smoothing. It's pretty much everywhere in theory of science right now. So Laplacian, we'll see one really crazy fact about Laplacian today too, which is the matrix tree theorem. You guys know the matrix tree theorem? Theorem for a tree. Okay, so get ready for that one later. But right now, what we want to see is that this Laplacian does what we want, which is it actually tells us what the forces are given the points. Right, so this is my thing here, is that F is equal to L times P, where P is our set of points. So P is some, let me just write it like this. It's an N by 2 matrix, where each of these rows is just the xy coordinates of one of our points. And you can just check that this, the force at a particular row here, is going to be precisely this. So if I take, if Q is one of the points, the terms, what will I get for it? I'll get Its degree times itself. I guess I get minus this. Does this come out backwards? Let's see. Maybe all the spring constants are negative one. Who remembers? Let's see. The force is equal to K times displacement. And I want them to be pulling. Is that going to be a negative spring constant or a positive spring constant? The negative?
I think so.
Right, so. Yeah, so it should be. So this should be negative one. Good. And so this should be negative, good. Because this is still true because this is now that. Good. So what do we get if we take our coordinates for the points, we hit it with the Laplacian, so we multiply L times P. And if I want to look at a particular column here, so let's say I take F I. This is going to be J equals 1 to n of pj times, I'm going to write this as delta, delta of j adjacent to pi. So this is a function which is 1 if this proposition is true and 0 otherwise. But this is exactly what we wrote over here. This is just the force. Equal to the sum of all pj adjacent to pi of pi minus pj. Or if you like, we could make it pj minus pi and put our negative one spring constant. So it's just the sum of all forces. And this is just a check that this Laplacian matrix is encoding all of that summing of the adjacent forces. And the way some of the terms disappear, right? We don't have to consider forces between points which are not adjacent in the graph, is because we have a zero in the Laplacian exactly at those entries ij where pi and pj are not adjacent. So Laplacian is going to give us a vector of forces given a vector of positions. Is this so useful? It seems like it's the wrong thing, yeah.
So in a three-dimensional graph, each of the terms is at least degree 3, right?
No.
No, okay.
At least 3.
At least 3.
Yeah.
So that means the Laplacian matrix doesn't uniquely determine the graph unless you have at least each of the diagonals greater than or equal to 3?
No. The Laplacian does determine the graph.
Uniquely?
Yeah.
All right.
Because if it's actually a bona fide Laplacian,
yeah,
then all you need to know is the information in the off diagonals.
Okay.
And the off diagonals are zero if there's no edge and non-zero if there is an edge.
Gotcha.
So it tells you everything about which edges are there.
So what are we using that as three connected?
We haven't explicitly used it. It doesn't come up in the definition here. You don't need three connectivity to talk about Laplacians. You don't need planarity to talk about Laplacians. But it is necessary if we're going to say that there exists faces that we can find for sure just by combinatorial means.
Okay.
And that there are, and it'll also come up when we say that there really is a convex representation because we need it for sciences then. It's just, in the case for convex representations, it's pretty clear that if you have a vertex of degree 2, it better be exactly on the line between these two. Otherwise, a face on one side, if it either, and one of these faces will not be convex. And so those edges are not so interesting to us. So if they're just degree 2 edges, they're not interesting, we can get rid of them. If they're degree 1 edges, you're really in trouble for a convex representation. But it's not, just having degree at least 3 doesn't guarantee you that you're 3 connected.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's at least necessary to have the degree left. All right. So we have the opposite of what we want. I tell you now that if I have the positions of the points, I can tell you what the forces are. But the point was to find the positions of the points. And I kind of already told you I know what I want the forces to be. So it sounds like I have the opposite of what I want. So we don't want to just do this matrix multiplication. So we don't know what the matrix P is. So what do we want to do? What's it called when you do the opposite? In your algebra? Am I?
Does it have what?
What?
What is that situation? You
don't well, I say I know what I want the forces to be,
so
and I don't want to find
it. Inverse.
What's that?
So take an inverse.
Yeah, take invert now. Yes, there's another word for yes. We're solving a linear system. Well, it's almost okay, but you know, suppose there was an inverse here.
So how do you know if there is an inverse?
Yeah. Do you think there's an inverse?
And it could be a non-invertible to the singular matrix also.
Let's pretend there's an inverse for a second. Let's pretend there's an inverse. Right, so pretend it exists, so that means that L inverse times L is the identity matrix. And let's do something with it. So suppose I have, I know that F is equal to P times, or L times P. So now I can write the following. I can say that P is equal to L inverse, F. And say I fix all the forces to be zero. I want everything to be in equilibrium. The net force at every vertex should be zero. So that's L inverse times zero here. It's not so good. So any matrix times zero is zero. Linear operators. Fundamental requirement of linear operators is that they take 0, 0. So it just puts all the points at 0. You say, well, maybe there's some other solution. In fact, writing this as an inverse is not as interesting as just saying I'm going to solve the linear system for P. Right? Really, what I want to say is I want to solve LP equals all zeros, which generally we do by matrix inversion, but when you ask for this, you're saying, what are these points? And this is a little weirder than you're probably used to seeing, because you're probably used to seeing this as an n by 1 matrix. This is n by 2. It's no big deal, I promise. It's also going to give us an n by 2 matrix over here, which is what we want. Because this is every row here. Every row here is a force vector. It's a two-dimensional. Okay. Whether or not there are interesting solutions to the system depends on L. And certainly if there's an inverse to L and there's some solutions here. But we don't really expect this to work. Because if there was an inverse to L, I could stick any set of forces in here. In particular, I could set zeros and I would get interesting coordinates. I would get interesting positions. But we already saw, at least, We tried to apply our physical intuition to say that if all the forces are in equilibrium, then it should be everything contracts to a point. So the only interesting solution is putting all the points at zero. See, in this setting, I haven't actually singled out that outer face like I was supposed to. Right? The tut embedding is supposed to say there's some vertices that I don't care about the forces being zero. So let's put a big X through this and break apart this Laplacian into pieces where we say some of it comes from that outer face and the rest of it comes from the inner stuff. So, let me get my notation back. Okay, so I'm going to write it in block form. I call this L1. This is some matrix B, B transpose, and this is L2. Oh, was it obvious? Was it clear that L is symmetric? L is a symmetric matrix? Because this is ij and ji, same. And so I can write it in block form here, where this first block, this corresponds to the vertices. If remember, it's n by n, so there's vertices p1 to p, say ph, ph plus 1, all the way down to pn. And we're going to say that p1 to ph are the vertices of that outer face. Okay, so now we know that LP is equal to the forces. So if I write this LP equals this, and now I have the positions. What is this? This is P1 and P2, where P1, these are the positions of the outer face. So these are given to us. We know what these are. These are known. And our goal is to find these such that it's equal to some forces, where there's some force on the outer faces, which we don't care about, and only the rest has to be zero. Now, in all kinds of linear algebra algorithms, there's something that's very useful to do, which we've done here, which is that you can think about doing all matrix operations in block form. And so if you break a matrix into blocks, and you want to multiply it by another matrix, which is broken into blocks, as long as the block sizes correspond correctly, you can just do it. So you just replace your normal multiplication with matrix multiplication. So this thing really is saying that L1 times P1 plus B transpose P2 is equal to F. That's not the interesting one. It's also saying that B times P1 plus L2 P2 is equal to zero. Now, the graph Laplacian, this whole matrix here, this we know, this was part of the input, or we can at least construct it directly from the input. This positioning of the outer face, once we found the face, we choose this ourselves. We know this one too. P2 is what we're trying to find. F, we don't care about. In fact, this last equation doesn't have F anywhere. So the whole point is to go from something here to finding P2. So this is just our basic linear algebra. We're going to try to rearrange this equation to tell us what P2 is. So we get the following. P2 is equal to negative L2 inverse BP1. Boldly inverted some matrix. I just said, yeah, it's a matrix. Let's invert it. Now, after going through all this and saying, well, L is not invertible, well, that doesn't necessarily tell us that some minor here, some submatrix, is not invertible. And there's actually a pretty easy way to see that this L2 is invertible. Once you have the right technology, like once you've set up enough theorems from linear algebra. But I suspect it's not so fun for us to do that now, and I also suspect that you haven't seen them all before. It sort of was diagonally dominant matrix. Yeah, okay, so this matrix, I'll just tell you right now, is what we call L2 is positive definite. It's clearly positive definite because it's diagonally dominant. And positive definite matrices are invertible. Now, if you didn't understand that, that's okay, because what I'll do is I'll tell you instead how Tutte proved this matrix is invertible. It's way cooler, because he used so-called matrix tree theorem. B is just whatever was in this bit of the Laplacian here. So it tells us how the outer face connects to the inner face. So it has not, it has some negative ones in there just at the points where there's an edge from the outside, from the outer face to the inner face. But is it clear that this is an algorithm now? Assuming that we can invert L2, this is an algorithm. This says invert L2. Multiply by B and then multiply by P1. That tells you where to put your points. Cool, right? So it says we're just going to do linear algebra. And now in terms of the that original simulation idea, it says you don't have to kind of simulate moving the points a little bit towards the centroids. It says that you just solve the linear system and it just tells you all in one step exactly where to put the points so that all of those points are in equilibrium. It makes sense that this comes down to solving a linear system because the fact that a particular point is in equilibrium is just a set of linear constraints. In fact, you think of it as a single linear constraint that the point is at the centroid of its neighbors, and you have a collection of linear constraints. You want to find a solution that satisfies all of them at the same time. That's why we solve linear systems. Okay, so that's why this comes out to be nice. Linear systems kind of problem. Let's check, let's see Tutte's way of seeing that L2 is invertible. So there's an older theorem which goes back to the early part of the 20th century, which is that if L is a Laplacian, it's a graph Laplacian, for some graph G, and L prime is L with, with the first row and column removed. Then the determinant of L prime, is equal to the number of spanning trees of G. This is super cool. Think about that. If I give you a graph, and I ask you, how many spanning trees are there in the graph? Remember what a spanning tree is? It's a connected subgraph. That's a tree, connected acyclic subgraph. If you want to count them,
n power of n minus.
The number of them? It's determined to Hilpernick, so it could be, depends on the graph. If I give you a complete graph, maybe you get that many. That's like, is that the number of trees? You just give me the number of trees on n nodes or something. But it does depend on the graph, obviously. If I give you a tree has exactly one spanning tree. It also means that if I give you a tree, I take its graph Laplacian, I take out the first row and column, the determinant is 1. It's pretty cool, right? So this is a pretty heavy tool, but Tut wasn't afraid to pull this out to show that L2 now is going to be invertible. So what's a sufficient condition for a matrix to be invertible? Certainly, if the determinant is non-zero. So here we removed not just the first row and column, but in fact several h rows and h columns. It turns out that that's fine. If I take an invertible matrix and then I remove some more rows and columns, it's still invertible. So we just need to check that. Well, what does he say? He says, when we remove actually the first set of rows and columns here, what we get is L2 here is still connected. And this goes back to the earlier question, how do you know if you have a face just by looking at the graph? If you know you have a simple planar three connected graph, the only condition you need to know that it's a face is that removing that cycle doesn't disconnect the graph. So here's exactly what we did, was we removed that cycle. The remaining graph is still connected. And if it's connected, it has at least one spanning tree. So the determinant is non-zero. It's positive, strictly positive. So Tut used this, the matrix tree theorem, to show that L2 must be invertible. More generally, if you have a matrix this part matrix L2, another way, maybe a more modern way of seeing that this is going to be invertible, is you see that the diagonal entries, usually the diagonal entries is the sum, well, in the whole Laplacian, all of L, the diagonal entries is the sum of the absolute values of the terms off the diagonal on any given row or column. Because the diagonal entry is the degree, and there's exactly one, negative one term for every neighbor. And the degree is the number of neighbors, so in fact it all sums up to be zero. Okay. So the, but now when we take just a part of it, some of these terms on a diagonal are bigger than the sums of the off-diagonal terms. And so it's, in fact, strictly diagonal dominant. Yeah.
Did you say that removing a row and a column is like removing a cycle?
No. In this case, we're removing all of these rows and all of these columns. It's removing that cycle, the cycle which was the outer face. In general, removing a row and a column is really like removing one vertex.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
But it's not exactly that. Like, it's not like L prime is not the Laplacian of some other graph. Mm-hmm. Because...
Well, like, once you remove, like, the top row, it changes the rest. So.
Every Laplacian is singular, but they do have... Once you... this, the matrix tree theorem implies that if it's a connected graph, at least the rank is n minus 1. So we can actually do this inversion. We get L2 inverse, and that gives us the algorithm. Any questions? So now, if you wanted to do this for the planarity game, you do still have this problem, like, how do we find a face to start with? But that, I think, is a good one for next time. Let me just see if there's any other thing else I can squeeze into the last 5 minutes. Okay, so let me give now some sense for why this is any gooder. Okay, all I've given you is a way to find points so that every point is at its centroid, but why is that a convex representation? Why is that even non-crossing? It could still be terrible. Our physical intuition, I think, gets us in some trouble here, because at least physically, you can imagine that a spring system could get caught somehow where edges are crossed. Or, if you tried to really realize this spring system, you'd have to decide which springs go over and which ones go under, and you could tie them to knots. Okay, so there's all kinds of problems there, but let me just give an overview of how we're going to show that after you draw this, after you draw the points in these positions, you really will get a convex representation. So not just non-crossing, but every face is going to be a nice convex polygon. So there's going to be 4 bad things. That the 4 bad things that don't happen. Okay, so first is that on any face, we're going to have no zigzags. So no faces will have some part of the boundary will zigzag. Because obviously once you have such a zigzag, in fact both faces on either side of, on either side here are going to be non-convex. Or even if this is there's only, let's say the face is on this side. So any such face is not convex, it's not allowed. We want it to be a case that there's no self-crossing on a face boundary. You may recall that when we covered Gram scan, we saw that, well, okay, maybe all the turns go the same way, but you still need some other check that you really do have a polygon, because I can make it so a face doesn't zigzag, but it might cross itself. It might have some winding like this. If I embed the face in a way that winds, there's going to be crossing edges. And it's not, so it's both non-convex and it's not drawn. We want there to be no, what I'm going to call, overlaps, where you have an edge, and now for every edge, there's a face on each side of the edge. So every edge, there's exactly 2 faces. One might be the outer face, but it should never be the case that on a particular edge, let's highlight it, that there are 2 faces on the same side of that edge. So this, in fact, is also the critical condition in the homework problem about why you only need 1 in-circle test to do local Delaunay, to check locally Delaunay for an edge. Because if the algorithm guarantees that you don't have overlaps like this, so that every edge has the triangles on adjacent to each edge are on opposite sides of this line, of the line through this edge, then you only have to do 1 of those 2 tests. The 2 faces would have opposite orientation. So that's related to this, and we're going to prove that this doesn't happen. And the last is that I'm going to call this no winding. It's going to look a lot like this. In fact, it's dual to this, that when we have a particular vertex, if you look at the neighbors of the vertex, that they don't wind around. So as I look at this vertex, especially if you think of it in terms of some data structure you had to represent this planar straight line graph, if I walked around, if I have, maybe it's not so clear what I'm drawing here. This is a triangle. And if I have, usually the planar straight line graph is supposed to, I'm supposed to be able to traverse the edges around a vertex in order. But in this case, it kind of skips around. It skips from here to here to here. Down to here, 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 and it completes it. Right, so there's some winding locally, and this is again the kind of thing that's hard to visualize at first. But if I'm just constructing a triangulation locally by gluing triangles together around the vertex, I can kind of glue them around so they wind around twice before they connect back up. This is a bad thing. This is kind of a local double cover of the disk. So these are the four things, and we're going to have to show that none of these things happen. And the way we'll show it is to use the fact that the embedding has this this barycentric or centroidal property, where every vertex is at the center of its neighbors. And we'll be able to find certain kinds of paths in any such embedding. And we'll use those paths to show that if one of these configurations comes up, we can use the paths of the, really the paths that the forces follow to find minors in the graph, which are either K5 or K33, right? The complete graph on 5 vertices or the complete graph, bipartite graph on 3 and 3 vertices. But these cannot be, since these cannot be planar graphs, if they have such a minor, we'll have proven that the input graph itself was not planar. So, any questions? All right, see you next time.